The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Come in, Jared.
A scheme to destroy water supplies worldwide has gripped Stony Man headquarters.
Another dam was just destroyed. This time it's in our own backyard.
And one of their own has been caught in the sabotage.
Stony Base! Strike the Stony Base!
What do we know about the parties responsible? The CIA is clueless. The Peruvians have no leads that they're willing to talk about.
But for the people responsible, the destruction of the dams is only stage one.
Soon, there'll be many more people in need of emergency water supplies.
We want to know what you guys had to do with the bombing of the Southern California Water Conservation Authority dam yesterday.
I don't know of no dam, man.
This could take a while. We don't have a while.
Stony Man number 44, Thirst for Power.
I just blew the hell out of something.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
A new age of evil wanted to reform the world, and the plot to throw Egypt and Israel into a bloody war was only one step in the overarching plan. But if the true architects of terror wanted to continue their battle with him, Mac Bolan would not back down. They'd have to kill him first.
I have a message for Damascus. Al-Askari didn't approve of Kazan's operation.
Al-Askari? This soldier?
Yes.
Please do not send me to hell.
I want you to tell your masters in Damascus that I will visit them soon. Tell them to kiss their families goodbye as soon as they can, for their blood will flow in an unstoppable torrent. Do you remember my message?
Yes, I remember it.
Run. Go back to the base and pray I never see you again.
Mac Bolan would only back down when his body slipped into its grave. Until then, he intended to keep living and fighting as large as he could.
Colonel Stone, the general has turned a portion of his Sky Force back toward us. They're Predator UAVs. And they have improvised canisters of chemical weapons hooked under each wing. Pull back and we'll blow this place.
How are your men faring against the other drones?
They're hard-pressed, and 10 slipped away from it. You're not turning back, are you?
A wise man once said, believe 3 impossible things before breakfast. Technically, it's before breakfast, so let's go stop those missiles.
Don't miss a single heart-stopping moment with Mac Bolan as he risks all to prevent a bloodbath in the Middle East in The Executioner, number 315, Agent of Peril.
Come on, Mac. It's only 5 floors. A fall would only shatter your spine and leave you needing tube feeding and artificial respiration for the rest of your life.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Brian Cotter opened his good eye and blinked up into the early morning sky. A bright blue band etched between the high sandstone walls of the New Mexico Canyon, where he lay resting from the glare of the sun. The bird was a blur for a moment, its large wings flapping lazily. Then Ryan's sight cleared, and he recognized the creature as a snowy egret, rising from a bunch of cottonwoods 100 yards to the south. At his side, Jack Lauren hadn't stirred. A light breeze brought the familiar scent of sagebrush from farther down the trail. A tiny lizard scuttled out from under a frost-riven boulder, looking for a moment toward the two motionless figures. It decided they represented no threat and moved out into the band of sunshine, vanishing into a patch of Indian rice grass. Ryan glanced at Jack. The youth stirred in his sleep, his arm flung across his pink, light-sensitive eyes. The familiar mane of snow-white hair, markedly longer than in the old days when they'd ridden and fought together, spilled out over the dusty, cropped grass. The albino teenager had always been a survivor, but the dreadful events of the past few days had etched fresh lines of pain around his deep-set eyes and thin-lipped mouth. The bottom of the canyon was cool, barely in the 80s. Out in the open, it was way over the 100-degree mark. The two men had come alone, drawn by a common purpose, by a remembering and by a sadness. The rest of the party were camped among a bosque of aspens, by the clear stream that trickled steadily from the higher ground. It had become the main water supply for the spread where Jack Lauren had settled with his wife, Christina Ballinger, and where the recent joy of their marriage had been the bright little Jenny. A gopher snake slithered from its hiding place and coiled itself. Its tongue probed the morning air, tasting the two human beings. It found the vanishing flavor of the small lizard, balancing caution against hunger. Hunger won. It moved out into the open, following the tiny reptile. Ryan watched it go. Time was passing. He looked at his wrist chron. They'd been away from the others for well over an hour. Christy would already be worrying. J.B. Dix, the armorer, would probably be checking his own chron every now and again. Mildred Wyeth, the doctor they'd thawed in a cryo center, would be resting, maximizing her strength for the ordeal that they all knew would be starting very soon. Dean Cotter, Ryan's 11-year-old son, might be throwing pebbles into the fast-flowing stream, or sleeping, or hunting for snakes. Doc Tanner, the oldest of the group of companions, born in 1868, and time-trawled to the bleak post-Holocaust world of Deathlands, would likely be asleep, flat on his back, his eyes covered with a distinctive swallow's eye kerchief he always carried. The massive, gold-plated commemorative Lamar pistol would be holstered at his hip, and the ebony sword stick with a silver lion's head handle lying at his side.
Time to move?
I guess so.
The young man stood, stretching, showing the feline grace that made him one of the finest hand-to-hand fighters that Ryan had ever known. Though he had to admit that Michael Brother had the edge on anyone for sheer combat reflex speed.
Like time never existed.
How do you mean, Jack?
Like I'm still with you. Like quiet months were a dream. Like Doc's always with me.
At least you had them. Christy often talks about us settling down like you and Christina. Says how she wants to stop the running and the fighting.
Jack ran a finger around the collar of his denim shirt. His right hand rested easily on the butt of the huge, satin-finished 357 Colt Python Magnum with its 6-inch barrel. Ryan and JB used to tease the white-haired youth about carrying such an enormous cannon, but Jack had shown repeatedly that he was able to handle it. Christina had never liked the gun. On their last visit, she'd insisted that Jack put it away.
She never really took to us.
Chris? She appreciated how you saved her.
By chilling her brothers and her father. Sure. Good way to become friends.
They'd encountered the Ballinger family many months earlier. R.G., the father, the moronic, vicious brothers Jim and Larry, and their sister, limping with a built-up boot on her crippled left foot. Her blue eyes would never look at anyone, in case she got a fist in the face for rudeness. The girl's brutal world had been low on childhood and love, and high on violence. Jack looked around the canyon.
Best say goodbye. My favorite place.
It's beautiful.
The others not want to come?
I don't think so, Jack. Not really anything left for any of the others to say.
Suppose not.
They walk together through the hot crimson sand toward the three graves. Each of them had a marker, carved from wood. The letters burned neatly into the slab of beech. The two men stood side by side, silently united in grief. Ryan laid a hand on the slim shoulders of the teenager and stood with him in the stillness while they both remembered everything that had happened in the previous few weeks. Since the companions had arrived unexpectedly in New Mexico after the last jump. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Nanette Savard, Casey Jones, David Coyne, Sonny Lasky, Tim Carlin, Bruce Rauscher, Kate Torrey, James Lewis, Ken Jackson, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands number 22, Rider Reaper. Michael was weeping. It was the first sound that Ryan heard as he started to come around from the jump. His eye opened, slowly, painfully. It felt like something had been spitting hot sand under the lid. Ryan closed his eye again, aware that he had a ferocious headache, situated behind the empty socket of his missing left eye.
Fire blast.
Dorothy!
Ryan risked easing open his right eye again, and saw that the walls of light purple armor glass had vanished, which was the last thing he'd seen as they started the matter transfer jump from the buried military redoubt. Where had it been?
New England.
He remembered. Good. The brain scrambling that was always a consequence of a jump was healing already. Now the walls were a pale silver. That color also rang a dim and distant bell in the far-off reaches of Ryan's mind, but too dim and distant for him to claw it out of the shorted memory banks. The silver discs and floor and ceiling had all lost their brightness, and the last tendrils of ghostly white mist were disappearing above his head. Michael was doubled up in a fetal position, tears streaming down his cheeks.
Dorothy! Dorothy!
Now Ryan remembered. Dorothy was the young woman Michael had fallen in love with. She'd been about to join them on the jump, and then changed her mind. She'd opened the door of the gateway, and risked the destruction of the triggering mechanism that could have sent all of them into a whirling, infinite oblivion. There was no way of knowing whether Dorothy had survived, and there never would be. Ryan wriggled himself into a seated position, his back against the wall. His mouth felt like a stick he had vomited in it. His stomach still churned. There was a sore place on his neck that he couldn't recall injuring. Other than Michael, no one else had recovered from the jump. Next to Ryan lay Christy, her hands neatly folded in her lap, her flaming red hair packed tightly around her nape. The woman's green eyes were closed, and she was breathing steadily. Her legs were crossed, the cuffs of her pants ridden up to reveal her dark blue leather Western boots, with the chiseled silver points on the toes and the silver spread-wing falcons embroidered on the fronts. Dean was on Ryan's other side. A thin string of yellow bile dribbled from his lips. His head rocked back and forth, and his fingers kept opening and closing. He was as pale as wind-washed ivory. JB lay on his side, as though he'd tipped forward during the jump. Ryan's oldest friend, the armorer,
had joined the legendary trader and his war wags about the same time as the one-eyed warrior. JB's fedora had rolled across onto the far side of the chamber and lay by the door. Ryan could just see the folded glasses protruding from the top pocket of JB's jacket. Mildred was next in the circle. She'd been born on December 17, 1964, into a politically active Baptist family. She hadn't even been a year old when the KKK rode out of the night with their burning crosses and murdered her father. 3 days before the end of 2000, she'd gone into a hospital for minor abdominal surgery. She had been an expert in cryosurgery and cryogenics. It had been logical, when something went wrong during the operation, to have her traumatized body deep frozen. Then the nukings of the following month had devastated the entire world, decimating the population. Millions died during the Skydark, and tens of millions more of the rad sickness during the long winters. Civilization vanished, never to return. The United States of America reverted to a number of scattered communities, some of them small hamlets, some of them larger villes with up to 500 souls, run by gun-carrying barons. It became Deathlands. For nearly a century, Mildred had slept on, dreamless and dark. Then she had been jerked back to life by Ryan and his companions. The last of the group was Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner. In November 1896, Doc had awakened to another normal, cool, bright morning in Omaha, Nebraska, with his young wife and two children. Then his world had ended at the whim of the blank-faced scientists of 1998. They were working on a top-secret time-traveling project, picking candidates, or rather victims, and plucking them from their past into the uncertain present. Operation Kronos. Now, Doc lay on his back with his chin on his chest. His mouth gaped open, revealing his excellent teeth. His white hair brushed the shoulders of his frock coat. His cracked leather knee boots were stretched out in front of him. Christy opened her eyes, staring at Ryan, her vision out of focus. She licked her lips.
Gaia, we made it.
She touched the cold armaglass walls with her fingers.
Silver, have we been here before?
I think so, but I can't remember where.
Dorothy!
Michael? Oh my. Dorothy? She got out of... Did she get out?
Christy looked around the hexagonal gateway chamber.
Looks like she got out just in time.
Not sure. Last thing I remember was seeing her kind of transparent in the doorway. Guess we'll never know. Unless we press the last destination button. In the long blackness that followed the planet's nuking, most techno-wisdom disappeared, including how to work the matter transfer units. Ryan had stumbled upon the first of them in a long-buried secret redoubt, and had found that the closing of the chamber door was enough to trigger the operation. You became unconscious for a brief period of time, and when you came around again, you were elsewhere. Doc had worked briefly on the system, during the couple of years he was an unwilling captive of the scientists. But he had become so difficult and emotionally unstable, constantly seeking a stolen opportunity to try to get back to his own time and his lost family, that those who had trawled him from the past used the experiment to push him forward nearly 100 years into what had by then become Deathlands. But even Doc had no idea how to actually set coordinates on the gateway to be able to control where you jumped. All the codes and comp information had vanished in the rad violent months after the Holocaust.
Silver walls.
JB struggled to sit up, nearly losing his balance.
Been here before.
Michael, come on.
Dad, I feel awful.
Sit still, Dean, or lie on your back. It sometimes helps. It'll pass.
What's wrong with Michael?
I think that nearly having Dorothy come along, and then the way she freaked out and nearly killed us all, has tipped him over the edge for a while. He wasn't all that well after the last jump. Seemed real depressed. Don't worry, Dean. He'll get over it.
Michael uncoiled like a striking rattler, making all of them jump. His dark eyes were wide and staring, and there were flecks of white froth clinging to the corners of his mouth. Ryan found that his hand had fallen to his holstered Sig Sauer, easing it half out and cocking it before he even realized that he'd reacted to the sudden movement.
Get over it, will I, Ryan?
Yeah.
You'd know about getting over things, wouldn't you?
Everyone here has had loved ones that they've lost.
So what the fuck does that mean to me? Why should I be interested in other people losing their loved ones? Why should I, Ryan?
Take it easy, young Michael. Ryan is correct about all of us having suffered loss. Few more than myself, I dare say.
Michael stood, staggering to his left, and steadying himself with a fumbling hand.
Damn it!
The others were all up on their feet, wringing the young man.
She made her choice in the end, Michael.
Fuck choice, Ryan!
Sure. I'll drink to that any day of the week. But it won't change a damn thing. She's gone back to Quimby and her own people.
Michael punched the armaglass. Then he headbutted the silvered wall. He staggered, his hands going to his face. Blood flowed fast from a gash across his forehead, into his eyes and dripping off his chin onto the floor. Mildred stepped in close, lifting a hand.
Michael, let me put something on that.
Michael grinned through the mask of blood, his white teeth smeared with crimson.
No thanks, Dr. Wyeth. Save your doctoring for others. I don't need it and I don't fucking well want it.
Hell, it's just a surface cut anyway.
Let's get out of here. Can't stand being closed in like a grave.
Wait!
Michael froze in his tracks, a half pace from the handle of the armaglass door. JB had been polishing his glasses. Now he perched them on the end of his bony nose and peered at Michael.
You want to chill yourself, that's your right. Everyone's right. But you don't take others with you. You understand me, Michael?
Yeah, all right. Guess you'll probably shoot me if I don't do like you say, won't you?
Possibly. Ready to move out, Ryan?
I guess so. Wish I could recall which of the gateways we jumped to that had walls this silvery color.
I can remember. I'm honestly surprised the rest of you can't. Especially you, Dean.
Huh. Oh, yeah. Course.
Right, Dean. We're in New Mexico again.
We can see Jack Warren again.
The redoubt had been extensively damaged during a huge explosion on their first jump to it, blowing away half of the red-baked mountain. The battered, rusted communication dish at the bottom of the slope, where they'd all sheltered to save their lives, still stood there. Fortunately, the gateway in the control room hadn't been damaged, secure and safe behind the massively thick vanadium steel set doors. JB checked his lapel rad counter, finding that it was flickering faintly between the yellow and orange bands, but nowhere near the red.
Safe enough.
He looked out across the expanse of desert. The pocket navcomp had confirmed that they landed once more in New Mexico. They all emerged into a narrow, dusty passage that ended in a gaping hole, where the earth had been sliced away, destroying virtually the whole of the redoubt concealed above it.
Wonder how things are with Jack and Christina. And their baby. What was...
Jenny, Dean. Jenny Lauren.